Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Experts claim there is nothing tougher than a diamond. But at Diamonds Direct, we beg to differ. Have you ever met a mother? Strong, radiant, timeless. This Mother's Day, give her the gift that meets her match. With diamond jewelry starting at $200, plus Diamonds Direct's exceptional quality and unbeatable everyday price, you're sure to give her a gift that wows this generation and the next to come. Experience the thrill of jewelry shopping done right at Diamonds Direct. Diamonds Direct. Your love, our passion.
The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm JB Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Looking to step up your Mother's Day flowers? The Home Depot has an idea. Let Mom's green thumb do some digging with colorful flowers, pots, and premium soils to bring out the most in her patios, walkways, and gardens. Right now, get Vigoro Potting Soil, just $8.97 for strong, healthy, vibrant plants indoors and outside. Shop our wide selection online and pick up your order in-store and give Mom the gift of a beautiful garden. Get Vigoro Potting Soil, just $8.97 at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?
Get in touch with technology with Tech Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Tech Stuff. My name is Chris Paulette, and I'm an editor here at HowStuffWorks.com. Sitting next to me, as always, is the sunny and genial senior writer, Jonathan Strickland.
Hey there.
I totally took the wind out of your sails.
After that buildup, I just, I couldn't follow that.
I love it.
So today we're going to talk a little bit. You know, you might remember several podcasts ago, we kind of compared the paper technology world and the computer technology world.
I do remember that.
Well, we started thinking about other topics we could talk about that are kind of related to that. And one of those is an interesting question that a couple of people have asked, not just us, but in general. And that question is, how much electricity does the internet require to work?
Lots.
Yeah. But if you wanted to get a little more specific.
Actually, nobody knows.
Yeah.
For sure.
We can get that out of the way first thing. We're going to go ahead and be completely straight with you guys. It is practically impossible to say with any degree of certainty how much electricity the internet requires to work. Part of the reason for that is that you're talking about such a massive machine, really the biggest machine in the world. And it's constantly changing. It's growing all the time. The components are changing all the time. So what might be true today could be completely false in a year from now. It may be that perhaps 18 more data centers go online in every region in the United States, and that could change things. It could be that some sort of massive energy saving technology comes out, and that could impact it. So when we talk about how much electricity the internet uses, keep in mind we're talking about estimates and vague ones at that, because a lot of the data that exists out there that people base these sort of estimates on is more than a decade old.
Yeah, and it's one of those things, too, where people are sort of extrapolating based on numbers that they do know.
Right.
So, I mean, they're educated guesses when we do have an idea of what's going on.
Yeah. I mean, think of it this way. Even if we knew down to the very last device how many computers and smartphones and everything else were connected to the internet, including servers, even if we knew all that, we don't necessarily know how often they're connected to the internet. So just because a computer's on doesn't necessarily mean it's actually making use of the internet. So it's not putting a drain on any resources. So then you're talking about, all right, well, now we have to estimate not only how many devices are out there, but how much time they're spending on the internet.
Right.
So this is really about as fast and loose as you can possibly get and still have something to talk about.
Well, we do know that the machines that are using the most electricity on the internet are the servers, the data centers, which are sort of little internets in a way.
Yeah, you could say that the data centers on an individual basis, the server in a data center is using more electricity than any person's computer, really. Mm-hmm. Unless you're talking about, I guess, a supercomputer, in which case that's a little different, but if you're talking about sheer numbers, mm-hmm. there are so many computers out there that if you were to look at least some of the figures that I looked at, the biggest drain on the electric grid of the world, really, not just the United States, comes from consumer and corporate computers, not from data centers. And that's because just from a sheer scale, you're talking mm-hmm. about a huge difference in numbers. So data centers, yeah, there are a lot of them, and there are thousands of servers in these data centers, but we're talking millions and millions of computers, or even perhaps 1 billion computers. But I think that was a figure that was arrived at maybe a year or two ago. And so, again, not necessarily accurate now. They're probably even more.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And also, then we get into what is a computer. Before we get too far into all of these kind of vague discussions that are going to take up our next 20 minutes,
right?
I think it might help to kind of talk about energy and electricity in general and about how that's measured.
Sure.
So we generally talk about electricity in a term called kilowatt hours, which is a unit of energy, and it's essentially the equivalent to 1 kilowatt of power expended over the course of 1 hour. All right.
Okay.
So the reason why we do that is because energy is essentially a measurement of power times time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the amount of power times the amount of time that power is expended. That's how you get energy, and kilowatt hour, unit of energy. Now, when we're talking about global electricity use, as far as the internet goes, we're talking in the terawatt hour range.
Right.
And to give you guys an idea, okay, so a kilowatt is 1,000 watts. A megawatt is 1,000 kilowatts. A gigawatt is 1,000 megawatts. And a terawatt is 1,000 gigawatts.
Mm-hmm.
So huge number here. Enormous number. It's too big for me to actually imagine. I know it exists, but I can't fit it into my head.
Right. Right. It's nice of them to use these terms that we would probably be familiar with from things like bytes.
Yeah. It's
megabytes.
It's nice gigabytes. That it's not, you know, a jot and then a bitool and yeah. then four handspans and then a furlong. Yeah. That would be really confusing.
Yeah. I think so.
Thank you for the metric system. So here's a study that was done back in 1999.
Okay.
All right.
Right.
And it was done by Berkeley Lab's Environmental Energy Technologies Division.
Ah.
The End Use Energy Forecasting Group, led by Dr. Jonathan Kumi, who I've seen his notes on several different message boards about this subject.
That's true. That's true.
Dr. Kumi is still very much active in this kind of study. Now, back in 1999, the Berkeley group actually had money to conduct this study. I think he said that it cost somewhere around the $300,000 range.
Wow.
To do this study. Cause you're compiling lots and lots of data. You have to gather all this information and then you have to make sense of it. And that actually does take a lot of time and money. It sounds like it shouldn't, you know, it sounds like something you could plug into Wolfram Alpha and get an answer immediately. It's not the way this works. So Their analysis said that the total electricity used by office and network equipment is about 74 terawatt hours per year, which was about 2% of the total electricity use in the United States. And then if you were to throw in telephone switching equipment and manufacturing energy for semiconductors and computers, it knocked it up to about 3% of all electricity in mm-hmm. use in the United States. So why would you throw in the telephone switching? Well, because modems.
Right.
The study's done in 1999. It was based on figures from 1995.
Yep. And we didn't all have DSL lines and cable modems at that point.
Right. And so we're talking 74 terawatt hours at that time. That's a huge amount.
Yeah.
And this was just for the United States, too. This was not a global study. So we're really talking about just one nation. But the other problem that we have here is that if you're talking about figures that are based off of 1995 equipment, a lot has changed in the years between 1995 and now.
Mm-hmm.
We are using computers that have much more efficient monitors. We're using a lot more laptops, which in general consume less energy than a desktop computer would. But there are also lots and lots more of them. So you have to figure, all right, well, the energy efficiency angle, how much does that impact this equation? The number of computers, how does that impact it? And you start to see where the problem is here. You can't just easily adjust these numbers and say, oh, well, let's just, you know, we'll fudge this one a little bit and we'll switch this one a little bit. Without a full study, you can't say for sure how much energy is being consumed.
True enough. I actually I did a blog post on the Tech Stuff blog not too long ago in which I quoted Bobby Johnson, who published in The Guardian, the paper from the United Kingdom. And basically the information I had read, and there are actually a couple of articles in The Guardian about these topics. So apparently they are among those who are interested in finding out more. But there are a lot of people who are starting to become concerned by the energy usage from the internet. I mean, from what I can tell, experts believe that data centers on the internet use about 152 billion kilowatt hours of electricity per year. And that's 2% of the world's carbon dioxide emissions as well.
Wow.
As a matter of fact, 1,000 searches apparently create about the same CO2 emissions as an average European car going 1 kilometer, according to The Guardian. So, you know, that's just, I figure 1,000 searches in Google, that's, you know, probably as much as we do in a day at How Stuff Works with the editorial staff, maybe.
So I'm driving my Lamborghini 1 kilometer. Oh, it's average.
Yeah, I don't think a Lamborghini is an average European car.
Although don't you could destroy ask, my fantasies of how people live in Europe.
Although you could ask the guys at High Speed Stuff if that's
true.
Accurate.
That's true. I'll stop in next time they're recording.
But the thing is, the Climate Group says emissions related to computers are probably going to go up around 280%. That's 1.4 gigatons of carbon dioxide by 2020, because the internet is just growing at that sort of a rate.
Wow.
So that's pretty significant.
Yeah. And back in 2007, there were some people who attempted to take another stab at guesstimating, essentially. I mean, it sounds like I'm slapping them for their efforts. But really, when you get down to it, when you don't have the data in front of you, it is a guesstimation.
And it's hard to quantify something like this, too, because it's so, you know, right. How would you break down the energy from somebody's electric meter on the side of their house and say, oh, right. Well, you know, your fridge used, you know, an eighth of this.
Yeah, and you have to figure out as well, even with servers. I mean, there's a difference between the amount of energy a server will consume at a peak time versus a trough.
Right.
That's called your load differential there, you know, your difference in load. And the, if you have a really efficient server, the difference is going to be minor, like within the 5 to 10% range, where your server will be, consistent and is not going to vary wildly from full use to trough use. And that's just meaning that it's very efficient, not that it's, you know, underpowered or anything like that.
Right. You know, before we go on, I was going to say too that I think that I'm just guessing, but I'm betting that the data centers, the facts and figures that we're seeing from the data centers probably don't take into account the massive amount of air conditioning needed to keep those machines cool.
Right. Yeah.
So you're not breaking down the different, you're breaking down the building as a whole, you know, say, well, this Google data center uses X amount of electricity per year. Well, it doesn't say, well, part of that's the lighting for the people who work in the building. And part of that is the, you know, 53 air conditioning units sitting on the roof and all that stuff. It doesn't go any further than that.
Yeah. Well, there are some studies that specify whether or not they take that kind of thing into account. And of course, not all data centers use air conditioning. Some use water cooling systems instead.
Sure.
And
I was going to mention something along those lines in a minute.
Oh, all right. Well, then I'll leave that for then. But the, actually, I should say that when I said load differential, that's actually my brain throwing a wrong word in. It should have been load factor. Mm. I'm just going to say that now because I'm sure people are already emailing me.
They paused the podcast and are writing to you right now.
But now that you've hit send, just know that I did eventually get around to getting it right. back in 2007, this other study that I was talking about, it's not even really a full study. There was a question online about, well, how much electricity does the internet use? And people were talking about this 1999 study and trying to extrapolate from that how much energy was being used at that time in 2007. So, the person who tackled this came up with some interesting numbers. He decided that, once he studied this carefully, he said that the world consumption in billions of kilowatt hours for data centers was 112.5 billion kilowatt hours.
Okay.
All right. The, PCs and monitors, 588 billion kilowatt hours. Wow. Modems, routers, and that sort of thing, 167 billion kilowatt hours. And then phone network, 1 billion kilowatt hours, for a grand total of approximately 868 billion kilowatt hours.
And that was in
2007.
Here's the thing,
that he was basing this off of figures from these older computers. Mm-hmm. So he's looking at power consumption figures from years and years ago. So we're talking about old CRT monitors, which were not as efficient necessarily as some of the LCD and plasma monitors that we have today.
Yeah. You know, I saw a number on NPR that was interesting. Their website said that, and this is not kilowatt hours, but they say that in the United States, more than $1 billion is spent every year keeping on computer monitors that are not really in use.
Right.
So
yeah, those monitors.
I don't know if that's, you know, how accurate that is, but that's, you know, I believe it. People leave their computers on and screensavers.
And monitors are pretty, they're pretty energy and hungry.
Yes,
and so put your computers to sleep, or at least your monitors. This 868 billion, it's one of those figures that some people like to say that's how much energy the internet consumes per year. And other people point out, well, that's not really true because we don't have enough information. This is taking into account old equipment. And yeah, while monitors have gotten better over the years, we've also had faster processors, which consume more power. So as monitors have become more efficient, processors have demanded more energy. So it's, again, one of these sort of seesaw things. You have to look at all the different factors, and there's no easy way to say, all right, well, how many high-end computers are out there? How often are they accessing the internet? How many low-end computers are there? Like netbooks, how many netbooks? Those are accessing the internet all the time because they don't have the native capabilities to really do everything you need to do on the computer itself.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why this conversation is a difficult one to have. But 868 billion, it's a good number to kind of keep in the back of your mind. That's sort of a best guess right now. But we're going to talk a little bit more about energy, I assume, because you had some stuff about water cooling systems, at least.
Yeah. One of the you're talking about supercomputers. I ran across some information about IBM's Power 575 supercomputer, which actually was linked to from one of the other posts. And I thought this was pretty cool because it's got it uses water chilled copper plates over each of its microprocessors.
Wow.
And that's a lot because there are 448 processor cores on each rack of this supercomputer. But the water cooling uses 80% less electricity than you would using traditional cooling methods.
So it's also much more efficient.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And, because, you know, using things like that could help us cut down.
Yeah. When you think about it, water is just – it's a better cooling system because it as a fluid, it is more efficient at carrying heat away. And you can just run water across using some sort of tube system. Obviously, you're not just dousing servers in water necessarily.
Yeah. You know, I tried that. Yeah. I just turned a hose on my computer and it doesn't run
that well anymore.
No,
at all.
I don't know why.
Yeah, that's probably a bad way to do a water cooling system. But you're doing it correctly.
And the fire department was upset too.
Yeah, I'm sure. The water will carry the heat away much more efficiently than air will. And you can then reclaim the water. You know, you
just cycle it.
Exactly. You just, you know, move it through so that it can release the heat and you reclaim the water. You cycle it back through. So it's not like you're using tons and tons of water and it's just going to waste. You're using the same water, you know, in the system, and then occasionally, I'm sure, replenishing it, but not like you just turned the tap on and let it go.
You know, I wish I'd made the turning the hose on the computer joke because I was going to say, yeah, and if you put the fish in there, the heat kind of cooks the fish. But
yeah,
you know, I've already made a joke, so I won't make that
soup.
One. You know, one of the things that I found that was funny was, and the reason I find it funny is because it's so contested. But blogger and author Nicholas Carr said he did a blog post that a lot of people disagree with a few months ago. But it said the Second Life avatars themselves, just keeping the avatars running, use 1,752 kilowatt hours per year. The average human uses 2,436 kilowatt hours per year. But the average person in Brazil, the average Brazilian uses 1,884 kilowatt hours. So basically, Second Life, people in Second Life use almost as much electricity as the average Brazilian, he says. Now, he's, you know, a lot of people disagree with him, but if it's even close to that, now they do, they leave the company that runs Second Life leaves the servers running and the avatars are on for as long as, that's the thing. They broke it down and said, well, you know, if the avatar is only on for 2 hours and there are, you know, such and such average people online, then it's not all the people on Second Life versus the average Brazilian who, you know,
right,
runs 24 hours a day. So yeah, I just think it's funny though to compare a virtual person to a human being. You know, I would imagine that I don't know how accurate it is, but I would imagine that it's got to run all those data centers to keep the world of Second Life going. You know, well, it would be at least reasonably comparable to what an average person would use.
Been in Second Life.
See?
They just need to hit that switch. They just need to hit that switch. I mean, you know, it's no reason to keep that going is all I'm saying.
Okay.
All right.
All right.
So,
I've got nothing more to say about Second Life. I've never tried it.
So. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you value your sanity. You just keep it that way. There are some cute things about Second Life. I wrote how Second Life works. All right. And uh-huh. There are some people who are legitimately using that as a way to make friends and have fun conversations and chat about all sorts of stuff. And they enjoy being able to modify their avatars. And so I guess they're the ones who are chalking up these kilowatt hours because they're the ones who are going back over and over again. Mm-hmm. But then there's everything else. And there's a lot of everything else.
Okay.
Yeah. And everything else, I mean, like some pretty hardcore porn stuff.
Okay, then.
Yeah. It's special.
Okay.
Right. I didn't write too much about that in the article, but yeah.
Wow. Okay.
All right. So moving on.
Yeah.
So, do you have anything else about electricity?
No. I just wish that we were able to deliver a hard and definitive number and say, this is absolutely it.
But I feel the same way. So if there are any research institutions out there who wish to grant us $300,000 to $400,000 to do a study, we will happily accept that money and we will see you in our research center, which happens to be on the Big Island of Hawaii. It's just that was the best place we could put it. So if you want to give us that, we will report back to you in 10, maybe 15 years.
Okay, then. Sounds good to me.
So I guess that just brings us round to listener mail.
Oh, no.
Today's listener mail comes from Chad from Montana. A big sky hello. First off, love the podcasts. You guys do an excellent job of explaining things in a way easily understood. You make tech stuff interesting and not overwhelming. Thanks. You're welcome. I have a question for you. I don't really recall hearing too much about bits and PCs until Windows Vista came out, and it seemed like it was front and center, and how software or hardware wouldn't be compatible anymore because one was on a 32-bit and the other was on a 64-bit. I'll be honest, I really don't even understand what they mean when they say 32-bit or 64-bit, and when I tried to ask a computer salesman what it meant, he couldn't even give me an easy answer. So this seemed like an excellent question for the Fab Tech Duo. How do bits work, and how is 64 different from 32? Trying to fit it into the how theme. If possible, please address Mac users and also Snow Leopard and Windows XP, Vista, and 7. Thanks. Well, Chad, here's the nice thing. Is once you understand how this works, it applies to everything across the board.
Yep.
It's not something where it's different for Windows versus Snow Leopard versus anything else. So let's start with bits. Now, bits are your basic information units, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
And they come in two varieties, 0 and 1. Unless you're using a quantum computer, in which case it can be both 0 and 1 and everything in between. That's a qubit. And we'll talk about quantum computers in some future podcast when both of us are ready to tackle quantum physics. But your basic bit is a 0 or 1. You can think of it like a switch, you know, it's like on or off. And then if you put two bits together, then suddenly you can have up to 4 integers represented.
Also, you'll have a quarter.
Ha ha ha, 2 bits. Nice. Shaving and a haircut. So, but you can have up to 4 different states using 2 bits. And by that I mean you could have a 00, 01, 10, or 11. And so every single time you add a bit, you increase the number of integers you can represent. And in general, for any number of bits, it results in 2 to that number in integers. So if you were to use 2 bits, it'd be 2 to the power of 2, which is 4.
Right.
Now, 32-bit processor can handle up to 32 zeros and ones all strung together in various states. And that results in, 4.3 billion integers. That's how many different integers you can have with a 32-bit system.
That's quite a few.
Yeah, but a 64-bit system. Now, 64-bit, that results in 1.8 times 10 to the 19th power integers, which, I looked this up, is 18 quintillion integers. Now, if you're wondering what a quintillion is, it goes billion, trillion, quadrillion, quintillion. So it's lots. Mm-hmm. Now, when we're talking about a 32-bit system or a 64-bit system, we're really talking about the processor here. All right?
Yep.
So your processor, what it's doing is it has a set of instructions that it has to complete upon a set of data. Now, the 32-bit or 64-bit, that refers to the amount, the kind of data that's coming into the processor. If it's a 32-bit processor, that means it can accept digits of up to the 32 bits. It can't accept anything more than that because it's just not capable of doing it. It's beyond its processing power.
Uh-huh.
So a 64-bit processor can process 64-bit information. So if you have a 32-bit processor, you cannot use an operating system that is the 64-bit variety because it is asking too much of your processor. Your processor can't handle that data flow.
At least not normally.
Not normally, no. And why would you want, why is this important? What's the 32-bit and 64-bit? What's the deal? It becomes important when you're using really high-end applications. Things like 3D modeling
or video processing,
maybe some really, really heavy audio processing too. Yeah. That can also do it. But video processing really, because you're talking about rendering and things like that. if you are doing cryptography.
Oh, yeah.
Cryptography involves factoring very large numbers. So the more, the larger amount of information your processor can handle, the more complex you can make your cryptography program so that it is very difficult to crack.
So essentially, it can handle more calculations.
Yeah.
And so more advanced, you're doing more advanced computing. You can handle more.
Right. It can do bigger calculations in the same amount of time that a weaker processor would do smaller calculations. I guess you could think of it that way.
Okay.
So yeah, it's not that the 32-bit processor couldn't run the same applications. It probably could. It just would be much slower.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope that answers your question, Chad. We thought we'd take a stab at any rate. If any of you have any questions, you can send us email at our email address, which is techstuff@howstuffworks.com. And if you want to learn more about bits and bytes or electricity or the internet, hey, guess what? We have articles on that. They're all at howstuffworks.com.
They are indeed.
And it is an awesome website, and you should all go and visit and click on lots and lots of articles written by Jonathan Strickland. So until then, I guess we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. And be sure to check out the new TechStuff blog, now on the HowStuffWorks homepage. Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.